WGNS, Murfreesboro.
This is FM 100.5, 101.9, AM 1450, and WGNSradio.com. Rutherford County's place to talk. Stand by, Rutherford County. The WGNS Action Line continues a search for truth.
Good morning to you. Welcome into the Action Line from WGNS. We're going to be focusing on MTSU today. And Buddy Pister is with us. The first segment, he is the chief of the Murfreesboro MTSU Police Department. And Buddy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Bart. It's good to be here.
Good to have you with us on this cool day. Yeah, we're up to 22 now. So getting a little bit warmer. You brought a friend with you.
I did. I brought our training sergeant and our PIO, Sergeant Brady Stuckey. And Brady is an expert in some of the areas we'll be talking about, or at least has a lot of experience there. So I'm sure he'll have some words of wisdom, as it were, to share with us as well.
Brady, good to have you with us today.
Good morning.
Tell us about, I noticed back in November you made some changes at MTSU as far as the security goes. Tell us a little about that.
Do you want to go?
Yeah, sure. Well, we had talked in previous months about wanting to provide an even better presence on campus. You know, we have a number of well-trained police officers that we use day-to-day in dealing with a lot of the issues that confront us with some of the concerns with having a large campus. We like to think that a lot of our officers that our officers have a lot of training that provides them with a lot of expertise to answer all types of questions and problems and be able to deal with community issues. But with that, we felt like we needed some more presence. And so we talked about and worked through a situation where we added some security guards to our campus to allow them to do some specific patrolling, to be in some areas mostly all of the time, so that folks could come to them if they have questions or problems, and so that those guards could kind of be eyes and ears for our police department in case they noticed something or needed to call us to assist with any difficulty or issues. And so far, since like you said, since about October, November, we have implemented those guards with some really good results.
I think a lot of people don't stop and think MTSU is a city, and not a small city. I mean, you're 20-something thousand people over there, and so you find crimes just like any other city would find, and you have a police department that's just like other police departments. I mean, it's not simply a campus security group. It's a real police department.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our officers are trained and taught that really there are two different categories of work that they have to deal with. One is enforcement and the other is service. And we take both of those responsibilities very seriously. Our officers, I feel like, are very professional in their application of the law, in dealing with offenders, in dealing with criminal situations that apply. Obviously, being a college campus, we do deal sometimes with a number of thefts and with some alcohol-related crimes. Those tend to be the things that we deal with for the most part. But our officers are also trained to deal with other situations, everything from violent incidents to, as I said before, property crimes and other things like that. Additionally, we offer a lot of services. So, we unlock cars and jumpstart cars, and we do a lot of community policing activities around campus. So our intent is to do both of those types of things as professionally and as well as we possibly can. Adding those security guards gave us another feature, if you will, towards our community policing efforts and towards having more eyes and ears around so that we feel like we can do our jobs even better.
I was told that with the security guards, the addition of those back in the last part of fall, that you were focusing mainly on the James E. Walker Library, the Student Health, Wellness, and Recreation Center, and the new Student Union Building. Are those areas higher in crime, or what is the reason for that focus?
Well, we had not had these types of security guards, contract security guards, before. So our first intent was to begin and implement up two guards to work in those more highly populated areas. So when we looked at campus and we saw places where people were all the time in larger numbers, that was kind of the core area of campus that we felt like that there would be more people. So initially we just wanted to put the guards out where there would be more people. And our plan is hopefully to be able to expand this program as more funds are available, as we can provide more guards to expand out into more of the campus.
One of the areas of study at MTSU is in training people to get into investigation work, police work, things of that sort. Are you able to use students who are entering that area as helpers with you at the police department?
Well, we are. We're able to use students who may have an interest in criminal justice matters, but we're also able to use students who actually have studies in other areas. As long as they're a student, they're interested in working with our department, making a little bit of money, but willing to do some of the things that we need them to do in a security vein, then we like to hire students, and we found a lot of really good ones that go to MTSU that we can use to help us to accomplish our overall mission of more securely keeping the campus safe.
As you look at MTSU's police department and the tools that you're working with, and I know I see the tools that the Murfreesboro Police Department works with, and we all see the tools that they work with on these TV shows. I don't know if that's real or not, but anyway, do you work with that type of tools? Is it pretty sophisticated what is happening today on the MTSU campus in law enforcement as compared to 20 years ago?
Well, we have to realize there are new technologies, there are new practices, laws changing all the time. We try our very best to keep our folks up to date with all of those types of changes. With our patrol folks, we try our very best to provide them with all the resources they need to be able to effectively do their job, because a patrol officer's job on a college campus has changed over 10, 20 years. Our investigative unit, we have added resources to them, access to databases, memberships to some organizations that give us more direct contact with some of the intelligence gathering entities throughout the state. We send all of our folks to different training. There's requirement during the year. So we're doing a lot of different things, and I know Brady could comment as well about a lot of the training stuff that we do to try to keep people up to date and even ahead of the curve, because you know our population, our community, is just as important and just as vital as any other community around the state. And so we feel an obligation to do the very best that we can to provide them with quality law enforcement service.
Brady, I guess it's been about a week and a half, and you had a very intensive, real-looking training program. I mean, with frightening-looking scenarios that were happening out on campus. Tell us about that and how you feel that went.
Well, like Chief was saying, with technologies changing and the different resources that we've been gaining over the years, one of those we recently acquired was something called Simunition. Basically, those are very realistic weapons. They fire a type of paint round, and it allows our officers to go through training scenarios that brings a certain sort of realism to them. You know, you can run through the motions, you can work on tactics, but one of the things is the officers learning how vulnerable they can be if they don't use the appropriate tactics or the appropriate methods that they're taught. Every officer goes through 40 hours. Minimum of 40 hours training every year. Our officers, on average, all of our patrol officers average about 120 hours of training a year. Through block training sessions like the one we just had and other specialized schools, everybody goes through a basic 40 hours every year, but we try to stay ahead of the game with the amount of training that our officers have, and we try to mix it up. And that's another way that we utilized some of the tools that we've purchased, you know, different training aids, along with practicing the tactics. Obviously, because of issues that happen, you see them in the news every day. We have to be prepared for just about anything. You said it earlier, you know, we're a city. We're a city of 30,000 people within a city of 110,000 people. So, you know, the potential for anything to happen could happen any day, and we have to be prepared for it.
It just hit me, too. This is a strange thought to come across, but you know, we had been talking in an earlier program about how violence is so much in our world today, and a lot of it is brought on by these electronic games and things of that sort being so realistic. And it just hit me, here in Murfreesboro, we have a city with a very diverse age group, and some of that age group is never exposed to these electronic games. Mm-hmm. And so that is not getting into their minds. Your population is predominantly of the age group that has this information and they play these games regularly. Does that create more of a challenge for you than, say, working the beat in a city like Murfreesboro?
I wouldn't say it creates a greater challenge, because I would say that we're kind of prepared for that diversity. We're used to it. I mean, a college campus is a naturally diverse environment. Our key age group, 18 to 25, I mean, obviously you have non-traditional students, but we're kind of used to dealing with those folks. It's not really an issue for most of the people. It's just kind of something you deal with along with everything else. Over the years, law enforcement has changed, and we've had to adapt. We've had to learn to do things that, you know, traditional law enforcement over the years never had to. Everything from dealing with folks with mental illness to dealing with the elderly. I mean, that was never a traditional role for law enforcement for years and years. And now that's just one more thing that we deal with. So I wouldn't say that we focus on that one particular thing. It's kind of a hodgepodge of different things that we deal with. And it's about every 1 or 2 years something new comes along, and we're changing some of our training to adjust and basically address that situation.
How big is counseling as far as being an officer with the MTSU Police Department? I mean, it seems like you would almost, in addition to being an officer, need to be a counselor with some of these students who are having problems.
Well, law enforcement in general, that's kind of becoming the need. And where we're at, because we're an institution of higher education and learning, you know, we're kind of teachers, we're counselors, just the friend to go to, so to speak. But, you know, we still have the traditional law enforcement role. As far as counseling goes, it's kind of on a hit and miss base. Some people want to talk to you. Some people don't want to talk to you. But there's a lot of resources within the university itself that we can refer people to, and we're just kind of that first step sometimes. Sometimes they reach out for help, and they're looking, you know, just for somebody to talk to. We're that first step. We're visible. We're somebody to talk to, and then we can get them truly professional people to talk to. I'm not a professional counselor, but I've had about 17 years worth of experience in counseling and law enforcement, so you get pretty good at it after a while.
Buddy, I noticed that one of your goals with the MTSU Police Department is to reach out to the community as well. And I've noticed that with the RAD programs and different things of that sort. Is that having the end results that you were hoping for?
Well, I would say yes, and yet we have a long ways to go. Sometimes how much your community is helping you when you're a police department is kind of hard to gauge. There's no, that I'm aware of, no absolute test that you can just put out there and get quantitative results that say absolutely you're doing everything you can, the community loves you, they're talking to you, they're giving you information, they're helping you to solve crimes, they're helping you deal with all the issues that are confronting the community that a police department can aid in. And so I do know that we are doing more and more every year to come up with more innovative ways to put our officers out in the community and to engage with people, because I think that's really what it's all about from that community policing and community assisting standpoint. We have to try the best we can to develop those lines of communication, because I like to tell people that really the police officers are typically not the eyes and ears, the first eyes and ears of the community. Community members are. They're the ones that are going to see things first most of the time. They're the ones that are going to see the suspicious activity first most of the time. So while our officers can come across things and respond and react, we really count on our community members to let us know about things. That's what has intervened in a number of places where there has been threats and issues and things like that. So we really are doing more and more with getting our officers out, with planning programming, with partnering with different groups on campus to try to get the message out about we're here, please contact us, call us. We're working towards people being able to text us and, you know, all kinds of ways to open those lines of communication. And the challenge is our population doesn't just simply change every 4 or 5 years. Our population is changing almost every semester, at least to some degree, because people are coming in and out of our community. So we can't just do any kind of training and teaching one time and go, okay, that's done, because we turn around and in, you know, another 4, 5, 6 months, certainly in a year, year and a half, there's different people on campus now that really haven't gotten our message. So it's a continual type of thing for us. So we know that even with good results where we've had people that have reported things, we can't afford to just say, okay, we've done a great job and leave it at that. We've got to continue to prod people in the community to let us know about things and to work with them to try to help them with their problems.
I had not even thought of how your population changes and changes and changes. So that creates a unique problem in itself. Thank you for the great job that you do for the community, for the MTSU campus. And visiting with us this morning, MTSU Police Chief Buddy Peaster and Sergeant Brady Stuckey with us. He's the training department coordinator and the public information officer, too. Thank you both. Stay with us. Much more to come on WGNS. A survey was made last fall, and I think you're going to be surprised with the outcome. Buddy, have a super day. Brady, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bart.
Loud, we're proud, we're blue. WGNS AM and FM, your home for the Middle Tennessee Blue Raiders.
You can go all the way at Ford of Murfreesboro Truck Country USA. Game season may be here, but there's no games at Ford of Murfreesboro. Right now, drive away in a new Ford F-150 for just $17,990. Not one, every new 2013 Ford F-150 with an MSRP of $24,665 is just $17,990. Also, get 0% financing for 60 months. Hurry to Ford of Murfreesboro, 1550 Northwest Broad Street, or visit fordofmurfreesboro.com.
I'm David Lee. Come see me at Ford of Murfreesboro.
Hello, this is Lisa Halliburton from Bell Jewelers. At Bell Jewelers, we buy directly from our diamond source in Israel. Our long-standing relationship with our diamond cutter means we get to select from the best offerings first and pass the savings on to our customers. There's nothing like the sparkle of a Bell Jewelers diamond. Stop in soon and see for yourself.
Visit Bell Jewelers on Broad, across from Toots.
Play it again, sports!
Your fitness headquarters.
We've got our hands on name brands like Schwinn, Horizon, Bowflex, and more. Create your own discount. Bring in your old sporting goods and walk out with new equipment.
Play it again, sports!
On Thompson Lane.
WGNS Time Saver Traffic.
Good morning. Still dealing with that accident. I-24 westbound. It's around the Hickory Hollow Parkway exit. It's on the right shoulder, but still causing lots of congestion for us this morning. We also have traffic easing just a bit. Old Fort Parkway at Bridge Avenue, Old Fort Parkway at Chapin Place, Old Fort Parkway at Kaysen Lane, I-24 at 96, and Broad at Memorial. This weekend, it's the National Flea Market at Tennessee State Fairgrounds. Antiques, crafts, collectibles, and much more. That's this weekend. Rain or shine at Tennessee State Fairgrounds, located at I-65 at Wedgwood. That's Tennessee's largest flea market. I'm Randy O'Brien with traffic on WGNS.
Thank you, Randy. What about that Murfreesboro weather? Brought to you by First National Bank of Murfreesboro.
Sunny skies in our forecast this afternoon with a high temperature in the middle 40s. And we'll see a slight chance for a few light showers tonight with lows down to 27 degrees. I'm WGNS meteorologist Sam Donaisky. Right now, it's 27.
This is Frieda Morgan at First National Bank of Murfreesboro. If you're thinking about buying a home or refinancing a home, see Becky Walker or Jonathan Bolden at First National Mortgage Services, 2230 Mercury Boulevard, an equal housing lender.
Start your mornings with WGNS. Rutherford Issues with Brian Barrett. Weekday mornings at 10. The Midday Report with Zach Trotman. 11 till noon on WGNS.
Welcome back. On this segment of our program, we continue to spotlight Middle Tennessee State University. And this thing right now, it's MTSU Officer, Office of Consumer Research, Professor Tim Graf with us this morning.
Morning.
Tim, good morning to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
I understand you have made a very interesting study and back in this past fall. Sort of on consumer outlooks in this area. Tell us about that and how you came up with your findings, and then we'll jump into those findings.
Well, we have been conducting these consumer confidence surveys since 2000. Back in 2000 is when we decided to start the Office of Consumer Research, and one of the things that we do in the Office of Consumer Research is we conduct these surveys of local Middle Tennessee residents, surveying them on their outlook on the economy, just what they think about the economy, and in general, what the term you'll hear this referred to is as consumer confidence, just their overall confidence in the economy. Do they think the economy is good? Do they think it's strong? Do they think it's growing? Or do they feel the economy is going to be slowing down? And since we've done these for the last 12 years, for the first 8 years, from 2000 to about 2008, we noticed very strong confidence scores among consumer in Middle Tennessee. But then, of course, in 2008, we saw a sharp decline with all the housing problems and the financial crisis we had. And since then, we've been kind of mired in a kind of a depressed state of consumer confidence. People aren't too sure about the economy. They're not, they don't feel good about the current economy. They're not really too confident that it's going to rebound anytime soon. But interestingly, during last year, 2012, we saw a steady increase in confidence. People started to feel a little bit better. They got a little bit more hopeful about the future of the economy. But then in December, we saw another sharp decline. Just kind of fell off the cliff again. The total score, the numbers may not mean too much to people, but the total score, our consumer confidence score was 106 at the end of December. That compares to the mid and high 300s when we were in the 2000s.
Do you do this also for other areas of the country?
No, there are national measures of consumer confidence. The Conference Board, they do a national measure, and that's the one that most people hear about on the evening news. The University of Michigan does a survey of consumer sentiment. But back in 2000, that's one of the reasons we started doing this, because we realized that economies are local. Just like they say all politics is local, economies are local too. And just because people in the rest of the country are feeling a certain way about the economy doesn't necessarily mean that people in Middle Tennessee feel the same way. And what we have consistently found is that consumers in Middle Tennessee are much more confident. They do feel much more upbeat and optimistic about the economy compared to consumers across the rest of the country.
And I think we fared much better than other places.
Yeah, we do have a very strong economy. It's a very diverse economy, and I think people around here recognize that. They see businesses moving in. It's like a diverse stock portfolio. You know, when one goes down, we have other stocks to help bolster it. And our economy, we're not relying on any one industry. We have healthcare, education, entertainment, hospitality, logistics, manufacturing. So, like you say, it's a very stable economy. It tends to be the last one into a recession and often one of the first economies out of a recession. So that contributes to local consumers' upbeat feelings about the economy.
So would you say that this was a drastic decline?
Well, I wouldn't say drastic, but it was a significant decline, yes.
Okay, so it showed something happened quickly.
I think if you recall, at the end of the year, there were a lot of negative news media reports. There's a lot of negative talk about the economy. We had the fiscal cliff, we had the national debt, the fear of taxes, and we're noticing that right now with the increase in the payroll taxes. I was reading this morning that a lot of consumers are having to adjust their purchasing behaviors. They're spending less, they're shifting where they purchase products to more discount stores, just because they're seeing a little bit lower income in their paycheck.
And that fiscal cliff could reappear, it sounds like.
It could. So that, you know, maybe one of your questions coming up is, what do we expect in the future? Well, we're going to be doing
these. Do you have a crystal ball?
No, we don't.
Okay.
But we're actually going to be doing these surveys next week, next Tuesday night, Wednesday night, and Thursday night. So if anybody's out there listening and you get a call on Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday night from MTSU, a student at MTSU doing consumer confidence surveys, that's us.
How accurate do you feel these studies are?
Well, we're measuring consumers' perceptions. We're getting a random sample each time, just randomly calling people. We get a very good mix, a very diverse representative sample. We usually get around 400, 450 in each sample. How accurate? I would say they're fairly representative of what people think.
And do you compare your totals with other areas of the country?
The way we calculate our total score isn't directly comparable to the conference board, the way they calculate their score. But we can take certain questions that are very similar on our survey compared to their national measures. And when we do that, we find, like I said earlier, that local consumers are much more confident. They're much more optimistic about the future of the economy. They're much more optimistic about their own personal financial situation.
Now, students who are working with you on this project, they're looking at getting into this field as their lifelong goal, I guess.
Well, some may, most probably aren't. What we use is the students in our marketing research classes. So as a requirement for getting a marketing degree, you have to take a class in marketing research, and one of the requirements for that is to participate in our consumer confidence surveys. So I know I was listening to the earlier segment, and they're trying to involve students in the criminal justice system. That's what we're doing here. We designed it so that students would be a part of it. It would be an experiential learning for students. So it gives them a sense for how marketing research is done, how phone surveys are conducted, so that the next time they're sitting at home and they get a call from a survey, they'll know exactly what's being done and how it's being done.
For students who are thinking about entering this field, has it changed over the years? Has marketing research changed, say, this year versus 20 or 30 years ago?
Significantly, yes. We still have similar methods that we have been using for years and years, surveys, focus groups, traditional in-person focus groups. But the advent of social media, online focus groups, we do online ethnographies where we ask consumers to videotape themselves as they go to the shopping mall, videotape themselves as they bring their groceries home and unpack them and send those in via the computer, the internet.
With people, I've heard people talking about how there's volumes of information about your buying habits, your taste, and things of that sort. Is all of that compiled and you get a pretty good profile of what
you
someone
can.
Likes?
Often that's referred to as big data. That's a term now you hear, big data. And it refers to the mass amounts of data out there, the huge amounts of databases that we have on consumers. Because every time you buy something with your credit card, that can be tracked into a database. Every time you go online and purchase something, all that information can be tracked. So yes, there are huge amounts of data on consumers. The problem a lot of marketers are experiencing right now is that you get this analysis paralysis where there's almost too much data. And they're not sure how to deal with it. Because a lot of it is very quantitative from surveys, but a lot of it is very qualitative from social media. We can take a look at what people are posting on their Facebook pages, and a lot of that is textual, and you can't really combine it with numbers that you get from surveys. So that's the issue that a lot of marketers are dealing with now.
So the marketing field, in order to be accurate, and that's what you mm-hmm. want to be, is getting more difficult every day with more data.
In some sense, yes. It's certainly becoming more complex, yeah.
And once again, before we end this segment of the program, you're about to have another study coming up mm-hmm. This week, is that right?
Yes. What we do is now for the last 12 years, we have asked the exact same questions every time. We do these surveys, we try to do them about 5 times a year. We do them twice in the spring, once in the summer, and then twice in the fall. And the students in the research classes are doing the calling. And yes, we are doing these next week. So we'll see how the results compare.
And you say the exact same question. So again, it's on your confidence.
They're the exact, and we have to ask the exact same questions because that way we can compare over time. Because if we ask different questions, we wouldn't know if attitudes actually change or if it was just a result of asking a different question.
Well, that'll be interesting to see if optimism has increased or decreased.
We'll see. Yeah, like you were saying, we'll see if consumers perceive any of the fixes that have been made to the fiscal cliff, if if they perceive that as permanent or just temporary, or if it's affected them in any way.
So when somebody calls you, take the call.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have a lot of hang-ups, or?
Well, naturally we do, yes, because we're calling in the evenings. A lot of students wonder, well, why can't we do this during the day during our class period? But, you know, at 9 o'clock in the morning, people aren't home. So we call in the evening, and obviously we have situations where people are cooking dinner, they're changing diapers, they're just busy doing other things. So we do get some hang-ups, but from what I've been told on the caller ID, it does show up as an MTSU phone line because we're calling from the MTSU campus using their lines.
So that's a positive for you.
That is a positive. Students identify themselves as working for the university. We're not selling anything, so that does help increase the response rate.
Dr. Tim Grafe, director of the MTSU Office of Consumer Research, visiting with us this morning. And very interesting how this last fall, suddenly in December, we had a sharp decline in the way people mm-hmm. look at our future.
Yeah.
So hopefully we'll see a change in that. We're looking forward to jumping back up again.
Businesses and retailers are hoping for a big increase in confidence, yes.
Tim, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Have a super day. Stay with us. Much more to come. We're going to be talking about the Confucius Institute next.
Days are wide away. Yes, it, you could say I'm just unwinding. What you're looking for?
Turn your fingers into a microphone and talk back. WGNSradio.com is Rutherford County's online source for what matters to you. WGNSradio.com.
For decades, we've been telling you that Bell Furniture has first quality name brand furniture half price every day. Now this locally owned family business has pictures of some of their furniture on the internet at www.bellfurnitureonline.com. Save with Perry Bell at Bell Furniture, 1517 the New Nashville Highway, halfway between Murfreesboro and Smyrna. And on the internet at www.bellfurnitureonline.com.
Sunny skies in our forecast this afternoon with a high temperature in the middle 40s, and we'll see a slight chance for a few light showers tonight with lows down to 27 degrees. I'm WGNS meteorologist Sam Donaisky. Right now it's 27.
Be a hero for kids with cancer. Join Paul Dinaburo's third annual event, March 15th at Lanes, Trains, and Automobiles in Murfreesboro. Go to pauldinaburo.com and see how you can give hope to kids fighting childhood cancer.
Would you run for me?
Walk or run in the second annual Special Kids Race, March 23rd at Murfreesboro Medical Clinic, 1272 Garrison Drive. For more information or to register, go to specialkidsrace.org.
This is Chip Walters, and you're listening to Rutherford County's Blue Raider Station.
Yeah, we got them. MTSU Sports on WGNS, AM, FM, online.
To hear what the doctor will say.
Welcome back. And on this segment, we're talking about the Confucius Institute. Visiting with us this morning, Yiping Chua. How are you today? Good to have you with us today. Tell us a little about the Confucius Institute at MTSU.
All right, sir. Confucius Institute at MTSU was actually established in 2010. April, and it was co-established between two institutions. One is the Hangzhou Normal University in China, the other one is MTSU. And since its operation, and we have already recruited six Chinese teachers here, and I was sent by Hangzhou Normal University to work here as Associate Director. Thank you.
Welcome to Murfreesboro. Now, I understand that both the school in China and MTSU are very similar in history. Both of them started as normal schools, so to speak. And in fact, I think the one in China still is a normal school. Is that right?
Yes, yes.
And so similar size universities, I guess, similar communities. Tell us a little about, I noticed there was something that came from MTSU this week, I think it was yesterday, about some airplanes that China is working on to help the university. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not very sure about this.
Oh, okay. Well, we won't go into that area then. Tell us a little more about the Confucius Institute and how you now have a program to help students with a Chinese background work more in learning English as a second language.
This institution, the main mission is try to facilitate the understanding between the young people and the students and various sections of society to understand each other. So what we try to do to achieve this mission, and we try to do a number of things. Number one is try to meet the local needs to learn the Chinese language. This is a very big chunk of our job. That's to say, a lot of people in the local society, they try to learn the Chinese language. So we offer a vast variety of courses, Chinese language courses, such as for children. We have, for children who have never ever touched any Chinese, we have a beginning and intermediate and even advanced. And also we offer Chinese language courses for adults. For adults, we have also beginning, intermediate, and advanced. Some people, they have learned Chinese with us since I came. They are still learning. So, and also I give them opportunities to learn Chinese even in China. For example, last time we have a friend, Dennis Jeffrey, and actually he was a retired military personnel. And then I sent him to Hangzhou Normal University to study in Chinese for 3 weeks. Probably 1 month, I remember. And of course, we provide whatever assistance we can do. And right now, he can communicate basically quite well with us in Chinese, okay? And also, besides that, another big section is we try to provide needs for those people, those kids who are from the Chinese heritage families. So from this semester on, actually, a number of kids from the Chinese heritage families, they're also learning Chinese, but the focus is different. Their focus is try to learn not just to listen and speak, but also to learn to write. Their parents do not want their kids to forget about their home culture. Okay.
Now, when you write the Chinese language, the ones I've seen, it's beautiful. It's like art almost. Mm. Is that what you use still, or have you changed to similar characters that we see in the English language, in Spanish, and they all use similar letters? Or do you still use that very graphic lettering?
So this is a very good question you ask. Actually, Chinese language writing is very much different from the Western language.
Mm-hmm.
The Western language is a later based, so we have basically a set number of letters, but Chinese language is quite different. As you say, this largely in the eye of the Westerner is the graphics. So we should try to teach the kids to write certain kind of Chinese, each individual characters. And what is the components of each character? We teach the kids the components character, but the number of the components of the character is very much limited. So the kids, after learning the components for a period of time, they find that writing the Chinese character is not that difficult.
So in the characters that we see, the graphic pieces of art that it looks like, you are able to read those in a book just as you would letters if you were reading English.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So it's not just a thought that's being transmitted. It's a full sentence.
Yes. We will teach kids original Chinese characters and teach them to read the character and try to learn to write the character. And eventually, they will be able to take part in the Chinese language proficiency test, which is also another big task of our job.
Now, you obviously have mastered both languages.
Yes.
Do you find one being harder than the other, or are they both equally difficult?
And I think that to the eye of most Westerners, that the Chinese language is very difficult to learn. But to me, this is something just we try to see from different perspective. For example, for English language, it is easier to learn to write, But there is something to Chinese that English is also difficult to learn. That is, the English language has a very large vocabulary, more than one meaning vocabularies. So if you want to become a very good reader, you have to master at least 10,000 vocabularies to me. But for Chinese, it's different. The number of the vocabulary is very much limited. If you know probably 3,000 Chinese vocabulary, you will become a very good reader. In other words, the number of the vocabulary is limited. So to me, the learning Chinese, the very beginning is difficult. But as long as you overcome the first step of recognizing and writing some basic Chinese characters, the second step might be easier because the burden of memorizing vocabularies might be less compared to that of learning English.
So you think an adult could go to MTSU mm-hmm. through the Confucius Institute, learn Chinese, and be able to go to China and comfortably talk with people there?
It depends how much time the student is devoted to that.
So. You know, I guess that could be true in any type of learning.
But actually, we are trying to send those students who can pass the language proficiency test to study in China with a Confucius Institute scholarship. That is something we try to get the fund from China to help those kids who are really to learn the Chinese language and culture, so that when they go into their profession, they can act as a bridge, as we are, between China and the U.S., so that they get more people in the United States under better about China.
Okay. Now, when you came to the United States and you're living here in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, how do you feel? Is it comfortable compared to where you lived in China? Is it similar? You look around, you see subdivisions. Are they similar? Are traffic patterns similar? People getting around the same way? Do you think that the two countries are more alike than we realize?
So I think there is a great lot of differences between these two countries. The customs, the habits, and one of the big difference is that in China, we have too much population. So the traffic is much worse compared to that to Murfreesboro.
So we've got it good and don't know it.
Yeah.
I mean, all the time, the thing we hear complaints about, oh, too much traffic. So you're saying, hey, you've got it pretty good over here.
Thank you.
So maybe we should look to you in China. Do you have a way to solve that traffic problem?
I think in China that the government's tried a lot of ways to try to solve the problem of traffic. One of the ways the government tried to do is try to, for some cities, they discourage the local residents to have private cars and try to increase the use of public transportation. So it is very easy to have a taxi, and also you pay very little money to enjoy this public transportation, the buses and subways. And in my home city, Hangzhou, and we have an ambitious plan to build subways mm-hmm. so that the people can go from one place to another in the city through the public transportation. So in this way, probably, and also they have a variety of other ways to make the roads wider and also have some flyovers, you know, and a lot of construction is underway.
So the roads are much wider, but then there's more traffic, you say, but they're trying to discourage people from owning their own cars.
In some cities, not all.
Not yes. all, okay.
Yeah.
Are the cars similar in China to what we have? I mean, do you see Chevrolets and Fords? I mean, we see, I started to say we see plenty of Chinese cars, but I'm not sure we see many. Do we have any Chinese cars here?
Chinese automobile industry, to me, compared to the United States, still underdeveloped. And we do not have many Chinese cars in the United States. But Chinese cars are... I think that there are quite a lot of automobile factories. They are joint ventures together with Japanese automobile industry and many others. And so that some of the cars, and actually when you buy the cars in China, and maybe it is the product of joint venture between Chinese automobile industry and Western automobile industry. And besides, the cars in made totally by Chinese automobiles, relatively cheaper compared to Western cars, because probably the tax is lower. So I'm not very sure about this.
Is gasoline hard to get in China?
I think gasoline is easier to get, but gasoline is slightly more expensive than that in the United States.
So you're looking for really fuel economical cars?
Yes, yes.
Are the cars that are built in China more economical to drive, have better gas mileage?
I think that for most Chinese families, car ownership is not very common to common people. At least only middle class can afford to own a car, because parking is very expensive, gas is more expensive, and the salary of the common people compared to that in the United States, we are dramatically lower. And I think the average income for most Chinese is probably 1/5 or 1/6. But if you want to own too many cars for one family, that is unrealistic, I think.
Do you have subdivisions? Do people own their own houses, or do they live in public housing and apartment houses?
Yes, this is a very good question. So actually, I think that for most, the great majority of Chinese families, they do not own houses. They only own apartments. And apartments is very, compared to the United States, are much more expensive, because especially in large cities as Beijing, Shanghai, and Hangzhou, and one apartment can be even more expensive than a house in Murfreesboro, because people love to live in the city. In the city, we have public facilities such as hotels and restaurants, big universities, and hospitals, mm-hmm. universities, and the people. Not like that in the United States, people live in the suburbs, and a lot of people even enjoy living in the suburbs. In China, it's true, some rich people live in the suburb, but most people, in order to avoid bad traffic, they like to live in the inner part of the city, so that they go to their institution to work. It's easier to travel to the place. It's much easier to save time and save money.
Do you have many American tourists visiting China?
I think many and many. That more and more Westerners came to visit China. In my home city, Hangzhou is one of the most 24 traveled city in the world, actually. It has a very beautiful city, a lake in the middle of the city. And every year we have thousands and thousands of Western travelers in Hangzhou. And actually last year, I brought 3 delegations to visit Hangzhou. They were very much impressed by the visit. One is the delegation of the Tennessee educators, and also the delegation of high school students, and also a delegation of MTSU students and professors. So they really liked this visit.
We're almost out of time, but before we leave this morning, how does the United States and China, how do they compare with each other? First, geographically in size, and also population size.
I think the population size, China is much bigger. We have more than 1.3 billion population, and the United States is 0.3 billion population, I remember. And also, these two countries are very influential in the world to me. And both countries, the people are very friendly toward each other. At least in Hangzhou, when the people from the United States visited Hangzhou, and they were very much impressed by the hospitality and the friendliness of the local people. And I think that as the world is enters this 21st century, the good relationship between the two countries is very important, and Confucius Institute wants to play a good role in consolidating and facilitating this kind of friendship.
We've been learning about the Confucius Institute at Middle Tennessee State University, and visiting with us this morning, Yiping Chua. Thank you for joining us. Hope you have a super rest of the day.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Stay with us. Much more to come. Truman comes along next on WGNS. Tomorrow, we're talking lawns and gardens. Mitchell Moat will be here from the Rutherford County Agricultural Extension Service.